From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. Earlier this summer, female sports writers traveled to Cooperstown to celebrate a major milestone for women. It was a development they never imagined when they first started writing about sports 40 years ago.
I can't believe I lived to see this day.
Here we were, you know, fighting Major League Baseball in court, saying we just love your game. We just want to be a part of it. We just want to cover it.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. Also, former NBA All-Star Vin Baker shares his story of recovery and Starbucks. Stay tuned. I don't want to alarm anybody who's dealing with back to school right now, but we're going to start this week by talking about report cards. Every couple of years, the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport issues a report card for newspapers and websites that cover sports. On the most recent report card in 2014, the grade for hiring practices when it comes to gender was an F. 99% of sports columnists and 90% of sports reporters were men. But that's actually a step up from the early days. Rebecca Shear introduces us to some pioneering female sports writers who celebrated a very big milestone this summer.
When I meet veteran baseball writers Lisa Saxon and Melissa Lutke, they're sharing a rented house in Cooperstown, New York, right near the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
I'm Lisa. Come on in.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Melissa.
Nice to meet you.
Nice
to meet you.
Yeah.
Wow. These lifelong baseball fans have journeyed to Cooperstown to celebrate a milestone in the world of sports writing.
I can't believe I lived to see this day, given what we all went through. Mm-hmm. And
no, I mean, it's absolutely a moment I never would have imagined possible back in the 70s. It wouldn't have even occurred to me. I mean, here we were, you know, fighting Major League Baseball in court for what we thought was just something that was so obvious, that we were here saying we just love your game. We just want to be a part of it. We just want to cover it.
Melissa's fight began in 1977. She was in her 20s, a hungry young researcher and reporter for Sports Illustrated. She was one of the only women writing about baseball at the time for any news outlet. She'd been assigned to cover the 1977 World Series between the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Dodgers. But even though both teams had granted her access to the field and the locker room, during the first game, she got a call that would change everything.
The commissioner's office called me and said, no go, we're in charge of the clubhouses. I don't care what the Yankees say, we don't care what the Dodgers say. I said, why are you making this decision? He said, well, we haven't pulled the players' wives. To which I said, what have you ever pulled the players' wives about in terms of baseball policy? And he said, also, he said, if we were to allow this to happen, the players' children would be ridiculed in their classrooms the next day. Those were the two reasons given to me why my right, which was on the clubhouse pass, given to me, was taken away. And, I mean, it was just, the clubhouse is more than just the quotes you get. It's the sensation. It's what you hear. It's what you see. It's sort of the tenor. It's the tone. It's what you pick up. It's what any good reporter just wants to be part of. And that was gone. That was absolutely gone.
Melissa and her employer, Time Inc., sued Major League Baseball for violating Melissa's right to equal protection under the 14th Amendment. In September 1978, they won that case, with the judge ruling that whatever locker room policy Major League Baseball came up with, it had to be equal for male and female sports reporters. But the commissioner of baseball, Bowie Kuhn, he just couldn't let that decision go. So the 1978 World Series rolled around, and it was time for his office to set the media policy for locker rooms.
And so he went back to the judge and asked if he really could set whatever policy they wanted. And the judge said, as long as it's equal. And so the very first night, he made this decision that there would be a period of time where all of the reporters would go into the locker room, and then they would clear the locker room of all the reporters.
The players would have 10 minutes to get dressed, and all the reporters would go back into the locker room.
This would be equal.
But this new policy caused an uproar.
Well, I recall that night vividly, because as they began to clear reporters out, the men started protesting. They couldn't understand how they could be treated this way, that they were being restricted in their time in the locker room. And you know, I didn't make one comment that night, but I watched it with the thought in my head that, you know, for the first time, you're understanding what our struggle, our battle, our fight, our lawsuit, you know, is about. And I will tell you, that policy lasted one night.
The next season, Lisa Saxon came on the scene as a sports reporter with the LA Daily News. Though in those days, she was writing under her maiden name, Nias.
The day I arrived to work, this was just the telltale sign for me. My very first day, I arrived to my desk and they had made a sign for me and it said token female.
That moment inspired Lisa to work even harder. She meticulously kept track of every single stat. And even though her salary was peanuts compared with the guys, she put in longer hours than anyone. So fast forward to 1982. Melissa had moved on to covering other sports, and Lisa now had the California Angels beat. The Angels' manager was Jean Mock.
I stuck my hand out and I said, "Hi, Jean, Lisa, Nias, it's nice to meet you. I'm going to be with the team for the rest of the season." He let my hand hang in the air. He crossed his arms and he said, "You can come into my locker room, but if you come into my office, I'm not talking to anyone." He turned on his heels and ran behind second base to watch batting practice, and I waved at him and I said, "Hi, Gene, nice to meet you too."
And Gene Mock made good on his, what, promise, threat? If Lisa tried to come into his office for post-game interviews, he wouldn't let anyone in.
So I used to have to wait outside the manager's office because the protocol after the game is first you talk to the manager, then you talk to the players. That left me in the locker room alone with the players.
And that's no small thing. So even though Melissa Lutke's lawsuit let women reporters inside the locker room, it couldn't control what happened once they got there.
Going in the locker room, knots would get in my stomach. Mm-hmm. It actually is a physically uncomfortable thing to do because you didn't know what you would face, and at the very least, you would have jock straps thrown at you and dirty undergarments. And that was an everyday occurrence, and then you would just build onto that what might happen, and you just hope for the best when you went in.
This, Lisa says, this is where she found her true angels among the California Angels.
While the guys were in talking to the manager, I could go stand by Rod Carew's locker with Ron Jackson, Papa Jack, and they were in a corner of the clubhouse where I couldn't see anything. And I could just talk to them until the other writers came out or the player I was waiting for was dressed. And I could say, "I need to talk to this person or that person. Can you let me know when it's a good time to go over?" And those guys helped.
Then came the 1983 season. Gene Mock had been replaced by John McNamara, who'd been hired away from the Cincinnati Reds.
I have to be honest with you. I remember one night we went in for the post-game meeting, and the first question to him is, "Why did you leave Andy Hassler in there?" Hassler had given up a home run. And McNamara threw the food off his desk, and he said, "All of you get out of here, except you." And he's pointing to me, and I'm like, "Oh, my God, what?" And so I stayed, and I said, "Yes, what did you need?" And he said, "What question was asked me, Lisa?" And I said, "Why did you leave Hassler?" And he said, "I'm going to tell you how to ask that question. What factors led to you deciding to leave Hassler in? Now, you tell me the difference between the two questions." So I said, "Well, one, I'm acknowledging that you had a reason for doing this." And he said, "Absolutely. And if you want to survive in baseball, this is how you're going to ask questions." And he said, "Now ask the question." I did. And he said, "You're the only one getting this answer tonight."
But even with Angels manager John McNamara on her side, 1983 was a tough year for Lisa. Players continued to verbally and sexually harass her. Other writers spread rumors about her sleeping with players. During a road trip to St. Louis, a security guard tried kicking her out of a hotel, accusing her of being a sex worker. By the end of the season, Lisa was this close to quitting her job, and she told John McNamara as much.
And he stayed up with me until 5 o'clock in the morning, talking to me. And he said, "I want you to clearly articulate why you're not coming back." And I said, "It's so hard. I face A, B, C." And he said, "You still haven't given me a reason, because none of them have to do with you. They have to do with other people. Until you can give me a reason why Lisa shouldn't cover baseball, I fully expect to see you back here next year."
And he did. Though now Lisa was covering the LA Dodgers. It was 1984, and at this point, although every clubhouse in the American League was officially open to women, some teams in the National League wouldn't let them in. But in spite of everything, what Lisa was determined not to do was complain.
Because if I complain, they're going to pull me off or use it as a reason
exactly.
To pull me off. And that's when I came up with my pat lines.
When a clubhouse attendant turned her away, she'd fire back.
I have a Baseball Writers Association of America pass that says I should be led into the locker room, and this says admit bearer, not admit bearer with penis. Are you going to do penis checks on everyone? Because if you do, you're going to find out I really have big balls.
By the end of the 1984 season, Lisa Saxon was exhausted. From the start of spring training to the end of the season, she'd only taken 2 days off. And it wasn't as if she had this huge support network of other female sports writers to turn to. In the mid-80s, she was one of just three women covering the majors full-time. There was her friend Claire Smith, who reported on the New York Yankees for the Hartford Courant, and Susan Fornoff, who wrote about the Oakland A's for the Sacramento Bee. But that was it. Still, Lisa Saxon was determined to keep on keeping on. But remember Gene Mock, the manager who ran away from Lisa when she introduced herself? The one who told her that if she tried interviewing him in his office, he wouldn't let anyone else in? Well, in 1985, Gene Mock came back to the Angels.
So I'm thinking, oh, God, please help me. And so one day I was talking to Gene, and he said, I just want you to know, I respect the hell out of you. You are the best writer on this beat. There is no one who knows more about baseball. But when I look at you, I see my daughter. And when I see what happens to you in that locker room, I think of my daughter. And I said, well, Gene, I want you to turn your thinking around. If you want to think of your daughter, that's beautiful, but change the script of her life. Your daughter wants nothing more than to be a baseball writer.
Gene Mock told Lisa that he still didn't like seeing her in his locker room, but he allowed her into his office.
That was my moment where I knew I'd been accepted. If I could win over Gene Mock.
By 1988, Lisa moved on to covering the L.A. Raiders and college sports. In 1989, she found herself having trouble concentrating. A doctor diagnosed her with combat fatigue. Lisa says she carried around a lot of hurt after her years in baseball. She had her share of high points, like that moment with Gene Mock, and her share of angels and allies. But by the time she left sports writing to teach journalism in 2001, she had a lot of healing to do. Since then, sports writers, male sports writers, have been getting in touch to apologize for not having done more to support her. And these conversations mean the world to her. But what happened in Cooperstown this summer means the universe. See, there's a pretty big reason Lisa Saxon and Melissa Lutke came in from L.A. and Boston, respectively, and rented a house, along with several female sports writers working in the industry today. You see, during Hall of Fame weekend, when the National Baseball Hall of Fame held its annual induction ceremony, for the first time, a woman received the highest honor the Baseball Writers Association of America bestows, the J.G. Taylor Spink Award.
To the BBWAA, to paraphrase dear, dear Yogi Berra, I want to thank you for making this day necessary.
This is Claire Smith, one of Lisa Saxon's few female compatriots from the 1980s. When Claire took over the Yankees beat for the Hartford Courant, she was the first woman to cover a major league team full-time. She also wrote for the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now she's an editor with ESPN.
Today, I humbly stand on the stage on behalf of every single person in my profession, in baseball and beyond, who was stung by racism or sexism or any other insidious bias, but persevered. You are unbreakable. You make me proud.
That Spink Award winner Claire Smith speaking at the National Baseball Hall of Fame in July. Our story was produced by Rebecca Shear. Sure, last weekend's Mayweather-McGregor fight was a spectacle, but have you heard about this?
Great fight between John C. Oram and Hugh O'Neill for $1,000 a side in gold and the ring money.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank RB Please for leaving the following review on iTunes. Inspiring me for two decades or more, I am loath to miss a show, which is why I write this review this week. Somehow, mysteriously, I was unsubscribed from OAG through iTunes. This has never, ever happened before, so while I am not ordinarily a conspiracy theorist, I am truly concerned that Only a Game and its listeners may have been the victim of some kind of online active measure aimed at de-inspiring listeners like me. that chance. Them Ruskies can kiss my A, asterisk, asterisk. Very sincerely, RB. Thanks, RB. Rest assured that we are on the case protecting your podcast stream from any outside influence. Seriously, folks, subscribing to Only a Game on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts is usually the best way to make sure you never miss an episode, and leaving a review is a great way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. This week, we're going to begin with the sports world's response to the extraordinary damage done by Hurricane Harvey. I'm joined by Cindy Bourne of The Washington Post and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks
for having us.
Cindy, please fill us in on what athletes are doing on behalf of those who've lost a lot, if not everything, because of the hurricane.
Well, it started very modestly on the first weekend when the hurricane hit. Clint Capella of the Rockets opened his Twitter feed to people who needed to be rescued, and he just simply retweeted them, and people were giving their addresses. They were saying what they needed. It was really incredible to watch it unfold. Kelvin Sampson, the men's basketball coach at Houston, put out a plea to all the high school and college basketball teams to send shirts and shoes, and he's been inundated with shipments. But the most incredible thing, really, was J.J. Watt, of course, of the Houston Texans, who was stranded in Dallas, and he put out a little video saying, you know, I'm going to put $100,000 of my money in this fund, and let's just see where it goes. You know, hopefully we'll match it. Well, it's now cruising toward around $15 million leading into the Labor Day weekend. I think even J.J. Watt was stunned. Now, as great as those feel-good stories are, the problem J.J. Watt now faces is he's got to deliver on this. Mm. He has to make sure that it's set up properly, that people are administering it properly. He's done a number of charitable things before, as many, many athletes have. But this isn't delivering, you know, 100 pizzas or a Thanksgiving coat drive.
Michael, I'm sure you have stories to add to J.J. Watt's.
Well, yeah, I know that two rookies for the Sacramento Kings, De'Aaron Fox and Justin Jackson, are both Houston natives. They've said that they plan on having a charity basketball game. And it reminds me of Katrina 12 years ago when NBA players actually played a charity basketball game in Houston to raise money. And this is where I find the issue with people who tell athletes to stick to sports. I think when you have a platform like this and you have the opportunity to have your voice be heard, this is what it's for, to do good for people. So a lot of times when people just shout out stick to sports, I don't think anybody's saying that to J.J. Watt right now.
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point. My only concern echoes Cindy's, basically. I hope that all these efforts can be coordinated in such a way that the donations get to where they need to go, because, of course, you also hear stories about people who are taking advantage of this situation to charge huge amounts of money for water and do all sorts of other nefarious things.
It's the American way, right?
And unhappily, they're both the American way, aren't they? Cindy, you want to wrap this up for us?
Yeah, the issue here is really the long run. You know, this is a years-long effort, and we're only barely into hurricane season. So it's great to see all this at the beginning. What happens next?
We're going to move on now to topics of far less significance. Michael, what's on your mind?
Well, as you all know, Jimmy Kimmel is a comedian. He tells jokes at night and makes people laugh. And Magic Johnson is an NBA legend and entrepreneur. His success on the court and off has allowed him to slide into his current role as Lakers president of basketball operations, where he's been assigned a return to franchise of glory. Magic is not a comedian. He doesn't tell jokes for a living, and his short-lived late-night talk show serves proof. But that was never more apparent than his appearance on Kimmel's show in April when he joked that he understood the league's tampering rules and winked and laughed his way through a conversation about how he could make Paul George, then an Indiana Pacers forward, know that the Lakers had interest in him without explicitly saying it.
What constitutes tampering? Like, if you're on vacation and you run into Paul George, are you not allowed to speak to him?
No, we're going to say hi because we know each other.
I see.
You just can't say, hey, I want you to come to the Lakers, even though I'm going to be winking like...
You know what that means, right?
It was funny to anyone not in Indiana or in the league office. And the NBA sent out a warning to prohibit the organization from dropping any more hints about pursuing a player who remains under contract. The Lakers' refusal to follow those orders led to the franchise being fined $500,000 for tampering, after GM Rob Pelinka made a prohibitive expression of interest to Georgia's agent Aaron Mintz, who happens to represent several Lakers. Now, tampering is one of the more complex issues that the NBA struggles to police. Teams talk to agents all the time. Agents represent players on multiple teams, and they talk to each other. What, if anything, can the league do to stop teams from getting a head start on wooing stars to other teams?
First off, I look at tampering, and I know it's a serious issue, but it's billionaires throwing sand at each other in the sandbox, you know? It happens in the NFL. It happens pretty much on all professional sports levels. I think that a $500,000 fine, while we all look at it and go, oh, you know, it gets our attention, is a drop in the bucket to the Los Angeles Lakers. And, you know, if you can pay a $500,000 fine and land Paul George, you know, you do that in a heartbeat, right?
Yes.
So while I know the NBA takes this seriously, these guys are spending time together in the off season. They're on the golf course together. So you're going to be standing there playing golf with LeBron and not say, you know, gee, I'd really like to have you for a teammate.
Yeah, I could just imagine that situation where the guy standing next to LeBron puts up his hand and says, hey, no, LeBron, we can't talk about basketball here. We're getting into tampering.
Exactly. Oh, we don't want to do that. And, you know, the only guy I feel sorry for here is poor Carmelo and the Knicks, because it's like, yeah, sure, we're going to come play for the Knicks. But, you know.
Oh, we'll hear from the New Yorkers.
I'm a former New Yorker. I would love to see the Knicks be good again, but, you know, that's a whole other issue and another show.
Okay. I'm going to talk about a boxing match from last weekend that got some attention.
Huh?
In a piece that was published after the Floyd Mayweather-Conor McGregor bout, Sports Illustrated's Justin Barrasso wondered if the event was a work, in quotation marks. In wrestling lingo, a work is a prearranged entertainment event rather than an athletic contest in which we don't know who's going to win. Barrasso's argument is that whereas boxing matches generally feature body punches, Mayweather-McGregor featured none. Whereas boxers don't generally turn their backs on their opponents in the ring, Mayweather did that a number of times. Barrasso is wondering whether Mayweather knew he would win and could dance around and do all this stuff because he knew that it was going to come out with him winning, and so did everybody else. If it turns out that Justin Barrasso is correct, will anybody care? Does anybody care if it was legitimate as long as they were entertained and as long as they could all say 100 million, 60 million, 30 million, a billion?
Well, as long as you can place a bet on it, I think, you know, I mean, seriously, it's fun to wager on sports.
If it's less fun to wager on a sport where the people involved know how it's going to come out and
exactly,
you don't.
That is very true. I cannot argue. But I kind of felt the whole way through like it was scripted. I agree with that.
Didn't Floyd Mayweather show up with a ski mask? I mean, if a guy shows up to an event wearing a ski mask, that should be the first sign that he's robbing me. I think that, you know, it's sort of like professional wrestling now. I remember as a kid, I was crushed when I found out professional wrestling was fake. I could not believe it was fake. And I never watched another wrestling match. But you know what? Wrestling is still alive because people are entertained. In boxing, I mean, if you have a way to make money by entertaining people, I don't think they care if it's fake. They don't care if it's real. And if it was a work, everyone wound up getting what they wanted in the end.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Thank you, Cindy, and thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
I think we've said quite enough about the Floyd Mayweather-Conor McGregor fight already, but that fight and that spectacle gave us cause this week to consider another fight-slash-spectacle. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
If you ever find yourself walking down the streets of Virginia City, Montana, as I did just a month or so ago, you'll find remnants of the Old West, former saloons and assay offices from the gold rush of the 1860s. Tourists eat ice cream in weathered buildings and walk past cases filled with wedding gowns of brides who came west for marriage. Near the far end of town, there's a little house, remarkably well-preserved. The plaque on the front says this was the former site of Leviathan Hall, where the longest documented bare-knuckle fight was held on January 2, 1865. Bare-knuckle fighting eventually morphed into what we now recognize as boxing, and it seemed odd to me that such a thing would have taken place in a town that today seems so remote. But come to think of it, Virginia City might have been the Las Vegas of the 1860s. On January 7th, 1865, the Montana Post dedicated its entire front page, six columns, more than 5,500 words, to the
great fight between John C. Oram and Hugh O'Neill for $1,000 a side in gold and the ring money.
They say that history is written by the victors. In this case, history was written by Thomas Dimmesdale, editor of the Montana Post and friend of the hometown favorite.
John Condell Oram, or as he is generally termed, Con Oram, was born in 1835 in Carroll County, Ohio.
Thomas Dimmesdale was effusive in his praise of the Ohio-born Oram. Dimmesdale himself was born in Thurlsby, England.
Oh, sorry. He spent most of his leisure time in the Rocky Mountains buffalo hunting and shooting game, and in this way became quite an expert with a rifle and bowie knife, and had many a hand-to-hand encounter with Old Bruin.
By the way, that's the voice of actor Mike Lovell. Oram was the veteran of many fights, including a loss against Owen Gagan, though Dimmesdale clearly felt that result was suspicious.
After fighting 19 rounds in 23 minutes, the mob broke up the fight on pretense of a foul, the referee, with a revolver looking into his ear, deciding against Oram.
Dimmesdale tells us far less about the challenger, an Irish miner by the name of Hugh O'Neill, except that
he has, more than once, settled the pretensions of some tough customers in the outside world in a style which boded no good easy times for any future opponent.
Maybe Dimmesdale liked rooting for the underdog. Hugh O'Neill had 53 pounds and 2 inches on Con Oram. Leviathan Hall was already considered huge, but it was enlarged for the fight, with a lean-to added around the part of the building closest to the ring. A brass band provided the pre-fight entertainment. In some ways, the fight was not so different from those you'd see today. O'Neill, the Irishman, wore green shorts,
with the old harp and stars and his name embroidered in full.
While Oram wore
the stars and stripes with the eagle, bearing the motto, "May the best man win." At 20 minutes to 2 o'clock, time was called, and quickly each man towed the scratch and began. Round the first was short and lively. Con got in his right on the ribs, receiving a facsimile from Hugh. The men closed in for the fall, and after a severe struggle, both fell, Con undermost.
Under the London prize fight rules, the round didn't end until somebody was on the ground. And because no one seemed to mind if a fighter went down just to have a rest, a round might end in seconds, or it could go on indefinitely. The fight would be over when one man, or both, could no longer continue. This fight really started getting going in the third round.
First knockdown for you. Loud cheers from O'Neill's friends and offers of 3-1 in hundreds against Oram.
By the end of the 17th round, both men were pretty bloody.
Heavy mauling from the word time. Con popped in his right on Hugh's olfactory department, which brought the ruby in a shower.
Was the end near? In a word, no.
Round 40. A sounding crash from Con's right under the left armpit. Hugh made for his man, and as Con was slipping down, assisted the operation by a nasty rap on the back of Con's head.
Oram had made a habit of intentionally slipping to the ground to end the round, and I might be reading into things, but this is where it started to seem as if Hugh O'Neill had had quite enough of that. But strategy is strategy, and you stick with what works, right? So the fight wasn't over yet. Not nearly.
Round 126. O'Neill's left eye closing. Nothing but misses registered. Oram slipped down.
By the 137th round, O'Neill was failing. By the 168th, Oram was getting faint. But neither man would concede. Finally, after O'Neill dominated the 180th through the 185th rounds, but didn't have enough left in the tank to put Orem down, the men who were attending to the fighters had had enough.
A sudden feeling seemed to animate the backers of both men, and the referee was called on by both parties to get the matter arranged. This was accordingly affected to the joyous satisfaction of every true blue present. Bets off, ring money divided.
The brass band likely struck up a lively tune, assuming the tuba player hadn't gotten tired and headed home. Ring money divided, wagers returned. Everyone was happy, except for the two men who endured 185 rounds without a winner. Con Orem seems to have come out of it okay. An ad in the following week's Montana Post reminded residents of Virginia City that Orem, owner of the Champion Saloon, was offering
private lessons in boxing and sparring once a week.
Hugh O'Neill wasn't as fortunate. A notice in that same issue announced that his friends were planning a benefit in his honor.
They are determined to make up for him a sum sufficient to leave him on the sunny side of Square instead of in debt.
But in all the care Dimmesdale took to record a round-by-round account of the fight, he neglected the one detail that matters most to history, the time the fight ended. Bare-knuckle fights were ranked not by number of rounds, but by duration. Dimmesdale wrote that Con Orem withstood
185 rounds in 185 minutes.
But this seems like poetic license. In the decades after the match, the legend grew. Some said the fight wasn't called off until after midnight. Best guess is that the fight lasted not 3 hours and 5 minutes, as Dimmesdale suggested, but somewhere around 5 hours and 30 minutes, meaning that Con Orem and Hugh O'Neill undoubtedly set the American record for number of rounds, which matters not a bit, and probably set the American record for duration, unless that record belongs to Jay Fitzpatrick and James O'Neill, who fought for 4 hours and 20 minutes in Berwick, Maine in 1860. But all of that couldn't possibly fit on a plaque on the side of a little house built where the great Leviathan Hall once stood and where tourists are told about two men, otherwise forgotten, who may have fought the longest bare-knuckle fight in history.
Thanks again to actor Mike Lovell, who lent his voice to the words of Montana Post editor Thomas Dimmesdale. That story was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. After losing nearly $100 million, former NBA player Vin Baker landed a job at Starbucks.
I was happy. I was ecstatic. I came from a dark, dark place.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, the new politics and history podcast that asks, what is happening? And has it happened before?
Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with decades of experience in Washington. He's a great writer, asks great questions, and always keeps us laughing.
Oh, Heather, stop. Okay, so Heather is not just a noted historian, but she's different. Heather lives in present tense, but also carries history right up with her to this moment.
Every week with our guests, we try and make sense of what's going on. We ask, is this completely unprecedented? Should we panic?
People are freaking out, both Democrats and Republicans. We want you to be able to take a deep breath and exhale. And by the end of the podcast, you will carry on.
Join us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Freak Out and Carry On.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, there but for the determination of a Supreme Court clerk would have gone Muhammad Ali to jail, that is. But now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Thursday morning, we learned that Kyrie Irving will, in fact, be a Boston Celtic, and Isaiah Thomas will, in fact, be a Cleveland Cavalier. The Celtics tossed in another draft choice after the trade had been delayed because Cleveland wasn't sure about the condition of Isaiah Thomas's injured hip. Did you ever doubt that these two guys would change teams?
When Cleveland made a run at both of the Celtics' promising young players, both last year's first-round draft pick and this year's first-round draft pick, I wondered a little bit, but pretty plainly Danny Ainge has swindled them nicely.
Plus, Isaiah Thomas was ready to go. He'd said he wanted a pail of money, and Kyrie Irving had said he didn't want to be a Cleveland Cavalier any longer. What were they going to do, go back?
Yeah, I had no idea what the league was going to do if somehow that fell through, although the Milwaukee Bucks were stepping up with an offer for Kyrie Irving if the thing with the Celtics had fallen through.
The NBA season won't start for another month and a half, Charlie, but if you want to bet today that the Golden State Warriors will make the playoffs, you can do it. Of course, you're shouldering odds of 1 to 1,000, which means to win $100, you put up $100,000. You want to go in on this with
no,
me?
No, that's okay. I think I'll let the rest of the Only a Game staff pull their money on that one.
Aaron Judge sits atop the list of American League home run leaders, but since he won the home run derby at the All-Star break, he's been batting about 180, something like 65 strikeouts. Okay, two options, extra batting practice or time off. Yankees manager Joe Girardi went with option number two, time off. Good call?
Yeah, he finally did. He fought that all the way through in a recent series up at Fenway. He got asked every night whether or not he was going to sit Judge down for a while, and he said he wasn't going to do it. Finally, it just got too obvious to ignore.
On Wednesday, Kansas City's Whit Merrifield hit a third-inning home run to end the Royals' scoreless inning streak at 45 innings. The Major League record is 48, shared by the 1968 Cubs and the 1906 A's. How'd the Royals break that streak? They throw the bats in the shower or saw them all in half and order more?
Weren't you supposed to mix up the bats? Isn't that what you do?
Yeah, yeah.
That's hard to do now because they have all those little cubby holes.
That's
so true. You'd have to pull down a wall.
Matthew Stafford, now the highest-paid NFL player of all time. His five-year deal with the Lions includes a guaranteed $92 million, including a $50 million signing bonus. Is it silly to say whether this is a good thing or a bad thing or deserving involved?
Well, I mean, it's always silly when you talk about NFL contracts because the money is very often phantom money that never gets paid. Mm. But still, the only comment I have is, Matthew Stafford, really?
Tom Brady wants more.
I was about to say, the New England Patriots can thank their lucky stars that Tom Brady is not in this for every dime he can get.
A private elementary school in Maryland has told parents that children are not to come to school wearing clothing bearing the name or the logo of the NFL team based in Washington, D.C. If you're the judge, when some parent takes the school to court for enforcing this rule, where do you come down?
Well, I mean, I would come down on the part of the kid, but the recent whittling away of the famous case Tinker v. Des Moines as to what you remember Bong Hits for Jesus lost at the Supreme Court level. So, I mean, I think the kid might be in trouble, but I would certainly support the kid's right to wear the Washington, you know, ethnic slurs.
The 2017-2018 NHL season has not yet begun, and that means there are still stories of the Stanley Cup and its summer travels. And so, I bring you the tale of Pittsburgh Penguins right winger Josh Archibald, who, along with his wife, had their son baptized in the Stanley Cup. I don't know if this guarantees that young Brecken Archibald will grow up to be an NHL player, but it'd be pretty cool if that happens.
They could do the whole Achilles thing and dip him in, hold him by one ankle.
No, he's sitting in it, man.
Oh, man, if 20 years from now when young Brecken goes to college, if he's got a photo of himself sitting in the Stanley Cup, he's the coolest guy in the dorm.
And finally, Charlie, we know of the Washington Nationals presidential races at ball games and the sausage races in Milwaukee. I had not known that for years the minor league baseball team, the Buffalo Bisons, have hosted the Wing, Cheese, and Celery, also known as the WCC race. This week, Celery won its first race in 450 tries, and so Celery will retire at 1-449. I really wish I'd been there to see the triumph of celery.
I'll tell you what, as a fan of celery, and, you know, a long-suffering fan of celery, I think they've finally gotten over the pimento curse. Why are they retiring, by the way? Is it like stale? Is it wilted?
Celery has nothing left to prove.
Well, celery never had anything to prove.
You can find
it's not a food, it's a garnish.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
According to Wikipedia, Vin Baker's basketball career was, quote, damaged due to substance abuse. Wikipedia is not known for precision, okay, accuracy, but in this case, the fault is understatement. But when we spoke recently, Baker didn't want me to lose his message in the ugly details.
So many people wait for the train wreck. Like in my situation, we wait for Vin Baker's lost money, Vin Baker's house foreclosed on. But when I get a chance to turn the story around and I fight my butt off and get to 6.5 year sobriety, I get it. I understand what people want to hear. But the fact of the matter is I'm here to shed light on recovery and speak to a world where sometimes people don't want to be honest.
For a long time, almost too long, Vin Baker was one of those people who didn't want to be honest. Now he's opening up about, for example, the first time he played an NBA game high. It was January 5th, 1996. He and several of his Milwaukee Bucks teammates had gathered at forward Glenn Robinson's place to get haircuts. There would be a game that night. Baker says Robinson was smoking marijuana. Baker, who'd never before indulged on the day of a game, joined in and then began to worry about how he'd play that night.
I went to the game feeling kind of disoriented. It was the anxiety of, am I going to be, you know, walking on air? Am I going to pass out?
Nope, neither of the above. Baker, about half stoned, shot out the lights.
Statistically, it was my best game ever as a pro. You know, I'd scored 41 points. It was a weird coming out party for me because in some ways it said, wow, I've arrived on this level to score 40 points, which is a big deal in the NBA. But at the same time, the cost of arriving, I didn't see that night.
A year later, the 6'11 Baker, whom the Bucks had picked eighth overall in the 1993 draft, was traded to the Seattle Supersonics. There he averaged just under 20 points per game, which was, at least in retrospect, astonishing, because while he was playing for the Sonics, Baker was drinking before, after, and sometimes during games. That didn't go entirely unnoticed. Sometimes Baker's teammates could smell alcohol on him at practice, but management saw only his upside. In 1999, Seattle signed Baker to a contract worth $86 million over 7 years. But 3 years later, Seattle dealt Baker to Boston, where he underwent a physical. The doctor employed by the Celtics found signs of liver damage associated with alcoholism.
And of course, being in the state I was, I lied and said, no, there's no issues, and I'm not drinking as much as you guys may think.
Baker says the doctor told him, of course, if you play better, this all goes away. Baker also recalls that in 2003, two men hired by the league to surprise him with random drug tests told him they'd warn him about when the tests were coming if he'd pay each of them $50,000. He thought about it. In any case, he didn't play better. By then, he was constantly drunk or hungover. He'd become a part-timer the Celtics could do without. Eventually, he began drinking Listerine, figuring nobody would complain about the odor. Over the next 2 years, the Knicks, the Rockets, and the Clippers came to the same conclusion that the Celtics had reached. In 2006, Baker was out of the NBA. His substances of choice had multiplied to include Xanax, Librium, and pretty much whatever else he could find to help him forget what might have been. He spent his days, as he says, shuffling around an empty house in slippers and sweats with a glass of cognac in his hand. He was, he says, skeletal. He vomited blood a lot. And then Vin Baker made what he figures was about his sixth attempt to get sober. What was different about the time that worked?
Well, I think I had to take out all the conditions that weren't realistic. So, in other words, I got to get sober to save my career. If I get sober, I'm going to be an all-star again. Those are like some of the crazy thoughts I had when I was in Boston.
This time, he didn't put conditions on it. For a hard year and a half, Baker maintained his sobriety, and then he began thinking about an additional goal.
I needed to get back into a place to provide, you know, for my family and for my kids.
Okay, good intention, but who was going to employ him? Baker came up with the name of a former boss, Howard Schultz. He'd owned the Supersonics when Baker had played in Seattle, and Schultz ran a coffee company, a place called Starbucks.
It must have took me about a month to call Howard. I was like, what am I going to say? And I had just left Bible study at my church in Old Saybrook, and I pulled over, like got my nerves together. I prayed, and I called him, and his voice, he was excited. He was like, Vinny. And I never forget his excitement and his voice. And he said to me, you sound great. Like, you sound terrific. We met and we came up with a plan and we exercised that plan. And part of the plan was to make caramel macchiatos and serve coffee at Starbucks.
Vin Baker went into the management training program. That meant he showed up dependably. And, as in his job in pro basketball, he put on a uniform.
To actually grab the green apron, that was a little bit short, by the way, grab the green apron and throw it on and then walk out, it was surreal.
Surreal, as in getting up at 3:45 to open the store. And at least initially, Baker didn't even like the taste of coffee. But he handled the job.
From the work perspective, it wasn't that difficult because I don't mind working. But obviously, the story behind it was difficult some days. But I ultimately said, this is all for the best.
Do you remember what the figure was on your first paycheck from Starbucks?
I don't. I don't remember. I can tell you this. Same signature from Howard. But it wasn't the same amount as I got when I worked for him in Seattle. I can tell you that much.
A couple of zeros missing.
Yeah, a few zeros missing.
Vin Baker can laugh now. He's been in recovery for 6.5 years, and he's not much inclined to look back at the nearly $100 million he lost.
I'm not going to be on the cover of Business Insider or Forbes anytime soon, but that's okay with me. Right? That's okay with me because in the world of recovery, we don't talk dollars and cents. We talk recovery one day at a time, win the day. So when I got the job at Starbucks as a store manager in training, it was the upswing. I was happy. I was ecstatic. I came from a dark, dark place. And to be able to open a store up at 4:30 in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, and run a shift and be responsible for a store is a big deal to a person in recovery. You know, it talks about responsibility. And so it wasn't $100 million to Starbucks. It was, wow, I'm the store manager at Starbucks. That's how I felt when I went in there every day to work.
People would recognize Baker, of course. There aren't a lot of 6'11 baristas. Probably also not a lot of baristas of any height as happy as Vin Baker was to have a job, which he eventually began to understand as more than a job.
At some point, I realized I might be the face of hope. Like, at some point, you have to take it on, the responsibility of, okay, everything has happened. You know, I had this amazing career. I had all this money. That's fine. And it's gone. But now, there are people that are like, wow, it's an inspiration. And I enjoyed it. I embraced it. If every day I walk out here and I'm showing up on time, people will go home and they'll Google. And they'll say, holy cow.
These days, those inclined to see Vin Baker and say, holy cow, are out of luck if they're looking for him at Starbucks. He's moved on to broadcast and development work with the Milwaukee Bucks, another former employer happy to see him healthy. He's working with a group to open rehabilitation centers in Milwaukee and New Haven, and Baker's reasons for gratitude don't stop there. His son, Vin Jr., will be playing basketball and studying this year at Boston College, much to Baker's delight.
Oh, man, I cried. It's one of the top 5 moments of my life to have my son sign at BC. When you see things like this happen in your life with your kids, like, I don't think about losing whatever I lost in the past or whatever I did in the past. I'm looking like the choices that I made to get sober now starting to pay off in my kids' life. And so that's what makes me excited each and every day about living a sober life.
You can learn more about Vin Baker's story in his recent book, God and Starbucks, an NBA superstar's journey through addiction and recovery. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Montana Post editor Thomas Dimsdale, who gives us one more description of his friend, Con Orem.
Firm, wiry, and healthy with a boxer's eye. Scarcely an improvement could be suggested.
Yeah, but Mr. Dimsdale, what about his opponent? Do you have anything nice to say about him?
His age is 34.
I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.